It's no easy assignment to come here today and face the descendants of the generation of New Lincoln here on the Illinois prairie that has changed so much since his time. A friend driving me over today commenting on how we didn't have to ford any creeks, and how the roadway was such that the rain ran off from it. No mud to plow through. A very curious legend, one of those things that don't happen often in history. That a man who was a plain man, a very plain man, so plain that he was a joke to some people. They hollered at him when he was on the platform, their jokes. And yet, he proved himself. Before he went to the White House there at Washington to take the helm of the United States government to guide the ship, he had never held an executive office. He had never been a mayor or a governor. The predictions were that he wouldn't make much of an executive. And yet, in one complicated situation after another, he kept his patience and his temper, and with every month in office, he increased in wisdom and, I will add the word, cunning. He had to have a jungle cunning to deal with the kind of enemies he had, and I don't mean merely the enemies, the military enemies, I mean enemies in his own party who couldn't see his policies. A grassroots congressman out of Kansas stood up in the House of Representatives in Washington on the anniversary of Lincoln's birthday in 1923. And this homely congressman from the Jayhawker State spoke that afternoon one of the best poems that's been spoken about Lincoln. The poets have done no better by Lincoln than this humble Kansas congressman, Homer Polk. There is no new thing to be said about Lincoln. There's no new thing to be said of the mountains or of the sea or of the stars. The years go their way, but the same old mountains lift their granite shoulders above the drifting clouds. The same mysterious sea beats upon the shore. The same silent stars keep holy vigil above a tired world. But to the mountains and sea and stars men turn forever in unwearied homage. And thus with Lincoln. For he was a mountain in grandeur of soul. He was a sea in deep undervoice of mystic loneliness. He was a star in steadfast purity of purpose and service. And he abides. And then on the 100th birthday anniversary of Lincoln, a Brazilian ambassador, Nabucco, at a centenary dinner to Lincoln in Washington, spoke. No poetry. But he gave the reasons, the basic reasons why Lincoln, why the name of Lincoln survives as it does. He said, with the increased velocity of modern changes, we do not know what the world will be 100 years hence. For sure, the ideals of the generation of the year 2000 will not be the same of the generation of the year 1900. Nations will then be governed by currents of political thought which we can no more anticipate than the 17th century could anticipate the political currents of the 18th, which still in part sway us. And then this remarkable sentence. But whether the spirit of authority or that of freedom increases, Lincoln's legend will ever appear more luminous in the amalgamation of centuries because he supremely incarnated both those spirits. By way of authority, he had been in office only a few weeks when he took to himself the powers of a dictator. He had no authority from Congress to declare a war, as the Constitution says the president should. He had no authority to take millions of dollars out of the national treasury and give it to men who would use it for purposes of saving the Union. Of the Constitution, he said, I will stick it in a hole when I have to. There are those who seek to destroy the Union, and they don't care about the Constitution. And it may be that in order to save the Union, I will not have to be too anxious about the Constitution. And yet, though he took the powers of a dictator, absolute power, he knew when to stop in the seizure of power. He had a respect for the Congress and its decisions. He had a respect for the will of the people and what the people said in their elections. Though slavery was the cause of the war, the cause of secession, the big national issue to him was union. He wanted, first of all, to save the Union. And so, across the first year that he was president, in none of his messages to Congress did he mention slavery or what to do about it. But when the time came to act, though he was told that it would be his political doom, he issued the Emancipation Proclamation. That was a terrific document. What did it do? You can look at it in the legal sense. Not from the viewpoint of what was right or wrong about one human being owning another. But from the standpoint of the Negroes being on the tax books as property, valuated at nearly $4 billion. And Lincoln decreed under military necessity, the federal government was confiscating that property, taking it, destroying it, giving no compensation to its owners. The most drastic act of its kind that the history of this country has ever known. But before he did that, he took a step of a kind that a real dictator, a man that liked absolute power, a step he would not have taken. In his message of December 2 in 1862, his message to Congress, he asked them to pass a measure that would authorize the federal government to buy the slaves, to give compensation to the owners of that property. Congress couldn't see it. Congress took no action, and therefore they went ahead in the wildest confiscation of property values that any president of the United States ever dared consider. We have a country here that's very curious among the nations of the earth. My friend Van Wack Brooks had a book out 3 or 4 years ago, The Confident Youths. It was about American writers and what they were writing about, and his ratings of who was worth reading and who not. And that book was reviewed over in England, the British Broadcasting System, the British Broadcasting Corporation. Their reviewer gave the gist of this book in saying that these authors that Van Wack Brooks favored, books that he wanted more widely read, they were books by American authors who differed from the expatriate Henry James, who said America, though Boston-born, said America didn't have deep enough roots culturally, went over to England after a time, became, there's some dispute about it, whether he became an English citizen or a British subject. There is a difference. But Henry James pointed out in his philosophy that we did not have in this country a state church. We did not have a true leisure class. And the reviewer said that Mark Twain would have replied, "Why, of course, we don't have a state church, and we don't have a military caste, and we don't have a titled nobility that is a sort of a custodian of our culture." Mark Twain would have said, "We started this country to get away from all of that." Of course. So we may not wonder if the Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., saying to Owen Wister, "Henry James, the novels of Henry James, 50 years of polite conversation and nothing doing." The novels of Henry James should have been written on white paper with white ink. A character there in the White House that would not have interested Henry James at all, no mention of him anywhere in his novels. The first humorist to occupy the White House, the first president with a rarely quick and wide sense of humor. He had barnyard stories that couldn't be told in polite company. And then throughout his writings and speeches, there are thin, delicate ironics comparable to passages in the New Testament of the Bible, where the thing that is being said is so terrible in its import that you can't say it in exact words. You have to rely on irony, sarcasm. Sangamon County, an old-time Sangamon County friend of Lincoln's, drifting into the White House, in the course of going over the place, he looked up and said, "Mr. Lincoln, tell me, just how does it feel to be
president. Well, I guess I'm like that man that the crowd rode out of town on a rail. He said if it wasn't for the honor of it, he'd just as soon walk. In the month of April in 1864, because of blunders, executive and military, and because of corruption, there was a brigadier general who wrote a letter to his wife in which he said, "May God save my country. If there is a God, and if I have a country." The outlook was dark. Lincoln, one night in the White House, read for the Quincy, Illinois lawyer, Orville Browning, read for him from a pamphlet written by a Philadelphia surgeon, Charles Still, where Still was quoting from a pamphlet about how Britain muddles through war. He quoted from a letter of the famous surgeon, Sir James Mackintosh, during the Napoleonic Wars, writing to a friend in Vienna. And in degree, the lines will go for this particular hour. I believe, like you, in a resurrection, because I believe in the immortality of civilization. But when, and by whom, and in what form, are questions which I have not the sagacity to answer. A dark and stormy night, a black series of ages may be prepared for our posterity, before the dawn that opens the more perfect day. Who can tell how long that fearful night may be before a brighter tomorrow? The race of man may reach the promised land, but there is no assurance that the present generation will not perish in the wilderness. It was that same year that at one time Lincoln said to a military man in the White House, he recited a whole series of disasters, and then said, "The bottom is out of the tub, I tell you, the bottom is out of the tub." Hope ran low with him at times. One very odd thing about this man, who is unfathomable, this Abraham Lincoln, one very odd thing, there never has been a president of the United States who, on so curious a number of occasions, wept, had the tears running down his face. And yet, the White House also has never seen a man of such mirth. And it was a Chicago editor writing a campaign biography of him in 1860 who had an odd little sentence as to Lincoln. "He has an exquisite sense of justice. He has an exquisite sense of justice." The only thing about the man that was ever characterized as exquisite was his sense of justice. His face and his figure had a quality of the comic. Here and there through that million word record of his utterances, odd little sentences that stick out and are of use for today. I had occasion a few days ago to follow a senator of the United States. And he had sketched the world situation as he sees it. And he had told what should be done about it. And I did not try to make any reply to him. I didn't try to correct him. I wouldn't have presumed to, but I did go so far as to quote from Lincoln's opening sentence of the famous House Divided speech in 1858. If we could first know where we are and whither we are tending, we could better judge what to do and how to do it. If we could first know where we are and whither we are tending, we could better judge what to do and how to do it. Then he went ahead and made that famous House Divided speech. And for years he got letters from people asking him, saying to him, writing to him, I have read that speech and I'm not sure just what you mean. What did you mean by it? And Lincoln would answer, would you be so good as to write me what you think it means, and I will reply as to whether you are correct or not. There came a time in the writing of that four-volume book, Lincoln, the War Years, that I read hundreds of pages in the Congressional Globe, hundreds of speeches made on the floor of the House and the Senate. And after a while it came over me that by far the larger part of them did not know the history that was in the making before their own eyes. We read today what they said then and we feel sorry for them because they could not read the trend of their times better. Either that or because they so indulged themselves in utterance. They so enjoyed spouting their opinions that today look so completely ridiculous and lacking in value. There was only a small minority of the members of the Senate and the House whose utterance record stands good today. Lincoln, of course, was one of that minority whose words stand good for today. They were very few. On the southern side, there was Robert E. Lee. You can go to what he said and wrote, and you don't feel sorry for him. He had care and anxiety about what he said and wrote. He wanted to mislead nobody by what he said and wrote. As a president, as a chief, he had a man who was rash in utterance, who did his thinking with his blood rather than his brain, Jefferson Davis. And the Republican senator from Massachusetts, Charles Sumner, was something of a parallel. I have 18 volumes of the letters and state papers and orations of Charles Sumner of Massachusetts. Bound in buckram, the rag paper and the printing, the typography just beyond criticism. But on nearly every page, as you go through the 18 volumes, on nearly every page, nobody home. What he thought he knew about the issues of the day and what to do about them. Today looks somewhat pathetic. A very curious quality. You can't live with that utterance record of Lincoln. Speeches and letters and state papers without being a little more guarded in your utterance. I could name some radio commentators, TV commentators, members of the Senate and the House in Washington, who could use some of that curiously cautious quality that Lincoln had in utterance, so that he misled no one. He wrote to a general in charge, a military governor of the state of Missouri, where there was truly civil war and chaos. He wrote to General Schofield, of course, was something he was very keenly aware of in his own position. If both factions, or neither, shall abuse you, you will probably be about right. Beware of being assailed by one and praised by the other. There was a delegation called on him, a committee of 80 from Missouri and Kansas. Radicals. He hadn't gone far enough, fast enough toward emancipation and a number of measures that they wanted to see enacted. When they had finished with their speaking and their complaints and their suggestions, Lincoln rose. And one of the delegates from Kansas wrote a very distinct memory that he had of the tears on Lincoln's face as he made a very brief address, saying that of their three demands, two of them he could not comply with, and he gave his reasons, and a third one he could accept, he could meet them. And what he said in the course of that speech was, as the Kansas man remembered it, "I desire to so conduct the affairs of this administration that if at the end, when I come to lay down the reins of power, I have lost every other friend on earth, I shall have at least one friend left, and that friend shall be down deep inside of me." The man had a strange and a quivering conscience. In that message to Congress, where he suggested that there should be purchase of slaves, there should be compensation to the owners of that form of property, he closed. He closed with a passage that some of us regard as having all of the values of the Gettysburg Speech or the Second Inaugural. He said early in the speech, "In times like the present, men should utter nothing for which they would not willingly be responsible through time and eternity." And then he closed, "We can succeed only by concert. The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew." He saw those men in the Congress bound by traditions and bound by opinions that he wanted them to discard. So he said, "We must disenthrall ourselves. And then we shall save our country. We must disenthrall ourselves. I think in the million words of the Lincoln utterance record, that's about the only time that he used that verb, disenthrall. An old Anglo-Saxon word in law. A thrall being a man, being a bondsman, bound to the land, bought and sold with the land. A serf. A thrall. Anytime he should break his bonds, he would disenthrall himself. Lincoln wanted them to break from the traditions, or he hoped on the part of some of them, their stiff-necked opinions. And he closed. Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. We of this Congress and this administration will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us. The fiery trial through which we pass will let us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. We shall nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of earth. And it's been good to meet you here today on soil that's part of what has become known as the Lincoln Country. I named my first book, Abraham Lincoln, The Prairie Years. He had his prairie years, 52 of them, and then went away. And when word came that he would never be back again on the prairies, that lovely gaunt old stepmother of his down in Coles County said, I knowed he'd never come back. The tallest American legend, a kind of a world legend, almost a fable of democracy. What's America? What's the United States over there between the Atlantic and the Pacific in North America? What does she stand for? And those who lack the theory say it's a country where a man can be born in a dirt floor log cabin. And slowly, by a circuitous route, reach the executive mansion in Washington. And hold in his hands, under certain circumstances, absolute power. That's the United States. So far, it's been very lovely that there never has been a man in the White House who, on occasion, might have used absolute power, but what, in the course of time, very nicely turned it back. Maybe I could close with an old Irish toast. Because your faces have been good to me. The best of luck before you, bad luck behind you, and the grace of God to guard and guide you. Perhaps I could open this little program with a song out of the 1830s, an Illinois song out of the 1830s. Way down up on the Wabash, such land was never known. If Adam had passed over it, the soil he'd surely own. He'd think it was the garden he played in when a boy and straight pronounced it Eden in the state of Illinois. 'Twas here the Queen of Sheba came with Solomon of old, with an assload of spices, pomegranates, and fine gold. And when she saw this lovely land, her heart was filled with joy. Straightway she said, I'd like to be a queen in Illinois. Then move your family westward, bring all your girls and boys, and cross at Shawnee Ferry to the state of Illinois. I don't know whether Lincoln ever heard that one. I wouldn't know whether he had heard the one out of Kentucky that made quite a name in its later days. Hello, girls, listen to my voice. Don't you never marry no good-for-nothing boys. If you do, your doom shall be a whole cake of hominy and sassafras tea. When a young man falls in love, first it's honey, then turtle dove. After he's married, no such thing. Get up and get my breakfast, you're good for nothing. They work gang song out of the South. They took John Henry to the steep hillside. He looked to the heaven above. He says, take my hammer and wrap it in gold, and give it to the girl I love, and give it to the girl I love. If I die a railroad man, go bury me under the tie so I can hear old number four when she goes a-rolling by. When she goes a-rolling by. If I die a railroad man, go bury me under the sand. Put a pick and a shovel at my head and my feet, and a 9-pound ham in my hand. A 9-pound ham in my hand. Hold my hand, Lord Jesus, hold my hand. Hold my hand, Lord Jesus, hold my hand. There's a race we must run, and a victory to be won. Every hour, give me power. I'm your child, Lord Jesus, I'm your child. There's a race we must run and a victory to be won. Every hour, give me power to go through.
Chilean coal. Ah, to we be do Lord, do Lord, do remember me. Do Lord, do Lord, do remember me.
I've got a raw throat. I've done fairly well this afternoon. And you've been very kind. This is a work gang song out of Georgia and Florida. Cold rainy day, some old cold rainy day, I'll be back. A rainy day, old Smoky Joe Lordy died on the road, saying I'll be back someday. Cold rainy day, some old cold rainy day, I'll be back some old cold rainy day. All I want is my railroad fare, take me back where I was born. Wood rock may be my pillow, Lord, the sand may be my bed. I'll be back some old cold rainy day. Cold rainy day, some old cold rainy day. I'll be back some rainy day. I know moonlight, I know a starlight, I lay this body down. I go to judgment in the evening of the day when I lay. Bound in jail all night long, one for to sing and the other for to pray all night long, one for to sing and the other for to pray all night long. Do Lord deliver me. Never seen the like since I've been born all night long. People keep coming and the train run long all night long. People keep a coming and the train done gone all night long. Do Lord deliver me. Ezekiel long, flesh come a creeping off Ezekiel bones. Church, I know you're gonna miss me when I'm gone. When I'm gone, gone, gone. When I'm gone, come no more. Church, I know you're gonna miss me when I'm gone. Hush, little baby, don't you cry. Know that your mother done gone to die. Children, I know you're gonna miss me when I'm gone. When I'm gone, gone, gone. When I'm gone, come no more. Children, I know you're gonna miss me when I'm gone.
That'll do for the services today. There might be time for, certainly for the shortest song in the American song bag. It was given to me by the daughter of the county judge out in Osage City, Kansas, and she learned it from hearing a Negro cleaning woman sing it while at work. This is an old Spanish custom. Got the man that I thought I had. Great God, I'm feeling bad. I ain't got the man that I thought I had. And that's all. And then, I don't know what American music would be without the influence of the Negroes across the time they have been here. On a ship, a fishing boat, off the coast of Alaska, a San Francisco newspaper man told me that a quartet of Negroes on the ship had to have a song. They made one that has its values. I offer it as being a creation that does not emanate from that peculiar American influence designated by the words Tin Pan Alley. The manufacture of hillbilly music has become an industry, one of our major industries. These fellas needed a song and they made one. Harvest moon, shine on. Keep on a shining, harvest moon, shine on. You'll keep on a shining. Oh, and I'm dead end. A graveyard is a lonesome place. I said a graveyard is a lonesome place. They let you down easy, throw dirt in your face. Comes a change in the ocean, change in the deep blue sea, change in the deep blue sea. I don't leave Alaska, there'll come a change in me. Perhaps there would be time for Colorado Trail. Which had its first publication in the American Songbag and then has been picked up by others. Eyes like a morning star. Cheek like a rose. Laura was a pearl.
wheel, winds of wail. All along, along, along the Colorado Trail.
Now, you've just been too good to me with my raw throat.